Yeah, I'm Miles, an alcoholic.
Hey, Miles.
So, just like last night, we're going to have two speakers, one medium length, one medium to long length speaker. But you're almost there. It's the bottom of the eighth. You're almost there. Once again, I'd like to thank everybody that's here, whether you're whether you're mandated or not, we appreciate it. You guys are awesome. I mean, we literally wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you. So we really appreciate it. Our first of two speakers tonight is a woman whom I have a high amount of level of respect for. She plays a very important role in the community in the Atlanta area. Atlanta, Kennesaw, Marietta, all the way up to Dahlonega. She was actually, I don't know if she knows, how big of an impact she had on me one day. When I was outside, I used to work at this establishment. And I was, losing my shit on the upper echelon and of the establishment, and Aaron kind of talked me off the ledge and really appreciate it, man. You really saved my face that day, because I was going to make a big ass of myself. I'm really excited. I've never actually heard her story, so I'm really excited to hear it and really look forward to what she has to say. Thank you all for being here again. I'll give you Aaron.
I'm Aaron. I'm an alcoholic. I'm an addict. I'm in the business of more if it makes me feel good, whatever it is. Today it happens to be ice cream, gifts of sobriety. I will have 7 years in November. And I have a sponsor. I have a grand sponsor. I have several sponsees. I do work in the treatment field, but I still take care of my program on the side, and I think that's the most important thing I can share about tonight. There's a few key points I really want to try to get across to you guys, and it's, number one, the internal condition that I have naturally, some of the spiritual principles that have, helped me out and continue to help me out and keep me on the straight and narrow path. One of those is honesty. Plays a big part in my story, whether it was not understanding and being able to be honest, and then learning and allowing other women to teach me how to be honest with myself and with others. and so practicing all of these things today. So the internal condition, I was born the youngest of five. A messed up family like most of us have. We all have our family stuff. Born in Marietta, so I'm from Georgia. And I grew up with this, anxiety and fear and just discomfort of being who I was. Always anxious, always fearful. I did not like school. I was painfully shy. I would have never gotten up and talked in front of a room full of people. I didn't even want to walk in the morning, when you get off the bus, because I felt like everyone was staring at me, judging me. Especially I had huge red hair. I dressed like a bad 90s lesbian. There were a lot of things that really made me stick out like a sore thumb. And so I never really felt safe anywhere. That's a big part of, that's just a big part of my story, too, of never feeling safe. And so school was not safe. I got bullied. I stood out like a sore thumb, like I said. My home life was really crazy and rocky. I grew up, my older sister had behavioral issues. She struggled with addiction. And so just kind of watching these things unravel at home, she would, frequently try to kill herself or hurt herself. She'd have to be 10, 13. There are always cops at the house. Her and my dad are physically fighting. And I'm just like a little kid kind of growing up in this. And so home wasn't really a safe space for me either. So I didn't have anywhere. I wasn't safe inside. I wasn't safe at school. I wasn't safe at home. And so some of the coping mechanisms I kind of came up with was, you know, living in an altered reality, right? That's what we like to do. I was able to do this without drugs and alcohol for a while. You know, and a part of this escape for me was just being somebody else in my head. It was going outside and climbing a tree and hiding in that tree for hours on end in a make-believe world. It was, you know, playing video games for 12 hours so I could just tune reality out. One thing early on that I did, I know now what to call it, but as a child, I didn't know. Whenever we'd have a really bad night at home, I would go outside and just, like, sit on the grass and look up at the night sky. And for whatever reason, now I know what that reason is, looking up at the stars in the sky made me feel this big. Because I'm looking up at the sky, it's so huge, I know there's another universe out there. And it made me feel this big, and it made me realize just how small I was and that there had to be something greater in this world than me. And so I would do that on particularly bad nights when my family was going all crazy and stuff, and I would feel some sense of, like, peace or some sense of it's going to be okay kind of come over me when I was able to connect with the universe in that moment, but it was always very short-lived. For me, into the depths of my addiction, that short-lived peace and sense of it's going to be okay continued to happen. It continued to reach me, whether I was shooting heroin, blowing down cocaine, drinking myself to death. You know, it didn't matter what it was. But what I know today is it was my higher power. It was God. God has always played a hand in my story. He's always been there. She's always been there. It's always been there, whatever you want to call it. Whether I was fucked up or whether I was stone cold sober, whether I was well, whether I was sick. And I know even at my darkest depths that I was always reachable, even when I didn't want to be. So growing up, I started doing drugs and alcohol. I took my first drink at 9. I just lived in a family of really great enablers, and so I was allowed to drink at 9 years old and continue to drink. About 12 is when the drugs started. Right before then, you know, my sexuality, I don't know if you guys noticed, but I'm gay. My sexuality played a big part in not feeling safe, not accepting who I was, not feeling adequate, you know, that fear and anxiety, because I grew up in a Southern Baptist family, and, like, I was a gay, drunk junkie, you know, I was just condemned from the start. So church was never a good place for me either. So my sexuality, I've always dressed like a tomboy. I have always played with X-Men action figures. I've always cut the heads off of Barbies, you know. And so at a very young age, my mom would, like, put me in pink dresses and those ugly frilly socks, you know, and those stupid shiny shoes. And I would hate it. I would feel so ashamed. I would feel so embarrassed. I didn't feel like I was being me and being authentic. And, you know, my mom would tell me things growing up like, oh, you can't hang out with gay people because then you'll be gay, you know, shit like that. And so that just further cemented this storyline in my head that said, you are not good enough. You are inadequate. You are different from other people. You will never fit in. You will never be loved. You will never be accepted. Right. So when I started doing drugs and alcohol, all of that fear was lifted from me, and I felt like I fit in. I felt like I was enough. I felt like I was the shit. You know, it didn't matter how I dressed or what I looked like. I felt comfortable in my own skin. And so I found my solution. Another one of, you know, the solution for me was also self-harm. I don't know if we have any, you know, self-harmers in this room. But as a child, I did not know how to deal with my emotions. I understood physical pain. I could deal with physical pain, but I could not deal with emotional pain. So all of that bad shit that I was feeling growing up, I would cut myself. And that would help me release that emotional pain in a physical way. And that's how I dealt with it. So self-harming, drugs and alcohol, checking out of this world, checking out of this life. You know, and along the way, I just lost all sense of what reality was, of any goals, of any ambitions I had. It was very important for me to graduate high school. It was very important for me to go to college. athletics were very important to me. But as I went along and the drug use continued and the alcohol use continued, you know, these things became less and less important to me. And those promises I made to my mom, like, I'll never be like my sister. I'll never tell you I hate you. You know, I'll never go to jail. I'll never do this. I'll never do that. All those promises just went out the window right and left. The only thing that was important to me was getting high, was getting drunk. And so y'all know how the story goes. I mean, we start with one thing and we progress to others. And, you know, then at some point in our story, we all think we're dope boy magic and we're slinging dope and we're, right, selling out of the bando and all that shit. And so that's a part of my story, too. That's another one of those storylines in my head where I could become someone different because who I am at the core is not good enough. I have this inherent need to be needed. This is a big part of why I made the decisions I made back then and what I do today to correct it. So I have this inherent need to be needed. And what I found was if I had drugs and I had alcohol and I had access to them, a lot of people really needed me. And it made me feel good and it fed my ego. And so my ego is actually a huge coping mechanism for me because it would allow me to survive, you know, whatever I needed to survive at that point in time. Whether, you know, it's messing with people I shouldn't be messing with, you know. I'm walking in and there's blood everywhere and, you know, this chick's in that room and this dude over here is not okay because he just got his ass beat and I don't know what they're going to do with him. And I would just put on that ego. I'd just put on that mask and it would help me get through that situation at that moment in time. And then I would go on to the next situation. You know, it didn't matter what group of people I was with, I could fit in because my ego just takes the form of whatever it needs to take the form of to let me survive. That point in my life was very stressful. I had dropped out of high school. I had gone back. Then they had kicked me out. And so I just dove deeper into drugs and alcohol and that lifestyle of selling dope to make money and, you know, fuel my addiction. Of course, there were consequences already. My parents' home was raided and, you know, there was a lot of prison time, you know, hanging over my head and all this shit. You guys know what happens. But what I will say is, the day that my life should have been taken during that period, I thought I'd have a bullet put in my head, and the guy that I was messing with selling for just let me walk away from it clean after I paid him what I owed him. And again, like, I can see God throughout my story. I can see God always there throughout my story, watching over me no matter how hard I was trying to kill myself. And so at that point in time, I was 16 years old, and I was a full-blown cocaine addict. I was blowing down like a quarter ounce a day, every day. I could not eat solid food. I could barely drink anything. I would just immediately throw it up. I couldn't. I was just constantly on the go. I would have to go hide out in hotel rooms for a couple days at a time just to take a break from all the stress of the lifestyle I was living and hide out from the cops and hide out from the people I was selling for and hide out from my family and just turn my phone off and shut it down, man, because the paranoia at that time, you know, was just too much and doing all that cocaine on top of it definitely didn't help. So basically what happened, you know, I got out of selling and that's when I really found heroin. And for me, heroin was my one true love, right? Like, I loved everything else. I really loved Xanax. I really loved alcohol. I really loved weed. I really loved hallucinogens. But when I found heroin, it was just over. And I was not a functioning addict by any means. Drugs and alcohol just, they immediately had their claws in me. I did not experience a slow progression. Drinking at 9 and not stopping up until I got sober at 24. What happened for me was, you know, overdoses. It was a rehab stint. If any of you guys know of Willing Way down in Statesboro, Georgia, it was a rehab stint through Willing Way when I was about 19. It did not go well. It did not go well at all. I think a lot of you guys are probably in treatment or sober living sitting in here right now. I didn't want to be there. I was forced to be there by consequences and legal consequences. I snuck drugs in. I got busted. I snuck drugs in again. I got busted again. I tried to walk off property. They came and got me. I fought. I punched walls. I broke my knuckles. I screamed in people's faces. I almost drowned from detox in the damn bathtub. You know, when I went in there, I had never actually detoxed from heroin before fully. And the night before treatment, I'd actually robbed my dope man with my cousin. And at that point in my life, I was 18 or 19 years old, and I had decided, the delusion was so thick in my head, I had decided God's purpose for me on this earth was to be a junkie, and I would die a junkie, and if I couldn't shoot dope, I had no reason to live. So I loaded up a hot shot to do and was just going to kill myself because I didn't want to go to treatment. I didn't want to not be able to be with my one true love anymore. And so my cousin walks in and he sees what I'm doing and he snatches everything up and he allots me, you know, the dope throughout the night so I don't kill myself. And so I went into treatment. I was so skinny and emaciated. They went to do the strip search and take my pants off and my underwear just fall down. You know, again, I can't eat. I can't keep any food down. They don't know if I'm a boy or girl walking into treatment. The other clients don't. the detox was so bad. I couldn't, for the first week, I didn't have any energy. You guys know how it is. I couldn't hold myself up. I couldn't walk. They pushed me around in a wheelchair. One of the techs there actually bathed me in the tub. I couldn't even bathe myself. And I remember she had hung my arms over the tub and so I wouldn't slip under. And she had stepped out of the bathroom for a second. And, of course, I slipped under. And in my mind, I'm like, dude, I'm going to drown. I'm going to freaking die in rehab. And I'm not even going to be able to get high again. This sucks. And that's all I thought about the whole time I was in treatment. When I get out of here, if I can just stack up this much money and I can fill up a little warehouse with this much dope, I'll be set. That's the kind of delusion I lived in my head. And no one could get through to me. So treatment came and went, and it didn't work out. And, you know, I went to a halfway house, and I ran away. And as soon as I ran away and I got back home to Atlanta, I immediately overdosed, and I was dumped and left for dead by my junkie buddies. And when the paramedics got me and I came to in the ambulance, you know, I never had any shoes on. Anytime something happened like this, I never had any damn shoes. And I'm always like, where are my damn shoes? Where did they go? But I'm barefoot and I'm bleeding from head to toe. And I come to in the ambulance and the paramedic's like, do you know what just happened to you? And I was like, where's my dope? Am I going to jail? You know, he's like, man, you were dead. It's like, no, I wasn't. He was like, yeah, you were dead. And I argued with him. I had died completely non-responsive for 4 minutes. They were able to bring me back. They told me I'd have brain damage. And I argued with this paramedic that I did not die. The denial was real. You know, so Grady Hospital, thank you, Grady, saved my life that night. And as soon as they released me, I took money out of my mom's purse, told her, fuck you, and I went and I got some more dope. And so, you know, I put my family through that hell for the next, I don't know how many years. And I had the stents of the methadone clinic, the Suboxone, the Subutex. But what I found was I never really wanted to be sober. I was just trying to avoid withdrawals. I was just trying to avoid consequences. I was just trying to avoid not feeling. But when I would put methadone in my system, I'd really want liquor. You know, when I put Suboxone into my system, I really wanted some Xanax. When I put any type of narcotic into my system, I want more narcotics. And so that's what I did. And so it didn't work like how it was supposed to work, I don't think. So I got my first DUI, methadone. I was taking like 120 milligrams, and I was filling two bottles of liquor a day, and I popped some Xanax and overdosed in the back of the cop car. So I woke up in ICU again. And that's just kind of how my life went, you know, for the next few years. It got to the point, though, you know, we can laugh about all this stuff because we have this mutual understanding. But it got to the point where I was so miserable and I hated what and who I had become. When I would get locked up and go back to jail, they would put me in those handcuffs and I would go, thank God. Somebody can stop me from me because I can't fucking stop. And I would go back to jail and I would get like 5 new girlfriends. It was awesome. And my parents would come and see me, and they'd be like, "What is wrong with you? You're happiest when you're in jail." Like, I don't know, man. You know, but what it was is my Aaron's will got stripped from me, right? Because all your rights, all your freedoms are taken from you in jail. I couldn't be out there running and gunning and copping dope and robbing people and doing all that shit. I couldn't stop, even though I wanted to stop. But then in jail, I'm making hooch, right? And I'm taking everybody's sleeping pills, and we're making the special Kool-Aid, you know? All this time, snorting those blue packs. I snorted coffee in jail. I am one of those. I am one of those gifts of desperation. you know, that's just how strong addiction had its grips on me. It didn't matter what the substance was. I was going to use it if it was going to make me feel differently. And so, you know, jail was like a vacation for me. I remember at one point, pretrial was going to try to get me out because I had a really low bond. And they came to talk to me, and I said, "Please do not bail me out, because if you get me out today, I'm going to go get high." And they were like, "What? Who does that?" I'm like, "You don't understand. Like, I need to sit in here for 6 months." I thought 6 months is the magic number. Once I get 6 months under my belt, I'm going to be golden. So I sat my ass in jail for 6 months. Pretrial came and bonded me out. And then before I knew it, I'm drinking NyQuil to help me go to sleep. And then I'm drinking NyQuil 24 hours a day. And then I'm drinking NyQuil on the way down to the bluff to cop some dope, because I know I shouldn't be doing that. And I have this big knot in my stomach, and I need a little something to take the edge off. That's how it happens, right? That's how it happens. I cannot put any mind-altering substance into my body, not even freaking NyQuil, because it immediately will take me back to the needle. I thought, I can just drink. I'm a junkie. I can just drink. No, I'm killing 2 bottles of liquor a day. I'm drinking nonstop 24/7. I'm no longer functioning. I have the shakes from head to toe from alcohol, and I'm 24 years old. And then I hate myself so much, I want to live my life in a blackout, so I'm going to take some Xanax with my liquor. But the problem was, the blackouts wouldn't last long enough. I don't know if any of you guys have ever experienced that, but the blackouts would not last long enough. And I would come to, and I would say, "Damn it, I'm still me. I'm still here. I just want to die." I didn't have the guts to kill myself, you know, and it was like, no matter how many times I overdosed or how many bad situations I put myself in, God just wouldn't let me die, and I just couldn't understand it, because I was worthless. I was useless. I was an empty shell walking around this earth, just surviving each and every day. I experienced what we call a spiritual death, and that is what finally brought me to my bottom, because it wasn't the consequences out here. It was the internal consequences that I had to experience before I could hit that bottom. It was like empty and desolate in here. Like, my spirit, my heart, my soul had died. It had left me. You know, it's like every time I stuck that dirty needle back in my arm, more of my soul would just leave me. And I felt like I didn't have anything left. I have been a fighter my entire life. I have fought everyone and everything. I've fought God. I've fought my family. I've fought myself. I've fought the cops. I've fought you guys. I've fought treatment. Anything good for me, I have fought it. And what alcohol and drugs did for me, once I stayed alive long enough for this process to happen, it took all that fight out of me, and so I surrendered. You know, there's been a lot of experiences throughout my addiction that were traumatic, and at the time, we just keep going, right? And we just say, it's just another day in the life of a J, right? Being dumped and left for dead, you know, a relationship I had, you know, my dope man sexually assaulted a girlfriend of mine, and I took on responsibility for that, because a month later she killed herself. And she would call my mom. I was locked up during this time, and she would call my mom, so messed up, thinking it was me and thinking I had sold her for dope. And that's what happened that night. And so she died, and there was no closure. There was no, you know, conversation to clear up what had happened that night. We both overdosed. She was taken advantage of. And she died with believing that, you know, version of reality. And so there's lots of stories like that, right? We all have those stories. There's lots of stories like that. My story things that I never dealt with. So when I finally was able to get clean and sober, that shit hits you like a ton of bricks. And you remember all that pain, and you remember all the agony, and you're actually feeling it, and you can't stop feeling it, and it all comes just flooding in, right? It's like the ocean, you can't stop it. I'll tell you a little bit about early sobriety. You know, early sobriety, I do not want to go back there again. It was a bad place. early sobriety, sorry. So we didn't have funds for treatment, you know. I didn't have funds for medication. I didn't have insurance. I wouldn't have accepted it probably anyway because I was totally all about not putting anything into my body, even though I could have used some mood stabilizers. I shook for like 90 days, you guys. Like, I shook so bad. But what I found is when I would come into an AA meeting, or when I would go into an NA meeting, and my hands would shake so bad, and you guys would pass out the stupid readings for me to read, and I couldn't read them because my hands were shaking so bad, the people sitting next to me would actually hold them for me. And then at the end, when we circle up, say that stupid prayer, and my hands shaking so bad, the people next to me would hold my hands a little bit tighter just to see that I got through it. And that's, you know, that's the kind of love that I found in these rooms. That's the kind of love I found from the fellowship that's sitting in here tonight. I didn't have a car, I didn't have a cell phone, you know, and it's exactly what I needed, right? A lot of times our priorities are so out of whack. Well, I need this, well, I need that, I need my phone, I need that new Apple iPhone, right? Or I need this, or I need that, and I need this brand of clothes. And we still come into like treatment and early sobriety with that thought process of what I need to be okay. And I wasn't given or had any of that, right? So it was totally stripped down to just me, and I wasn't much of anything. And so what I found through that was humility. What I found was after a meeting, I'm 24 years old, I'm asking you if I can borrow your cell phone so I can check in with mom. I'm asking if I can get rides to meetings. You know, I'm asking if I can go hang out with people because I'm lonely and I don't know what to do with myself. And it was humility. It's exactly what I needed, because if I had access to money, to transportation, to a cell phone, I was going to go get high, right? The first 30 days, I did not sleep. I hardly slept. And I was sleeping on the apartment floor, my mom's little one-bedroom apartment. I didn't have a bed. I didn't have anything. And every night, those voices would talk to me, and I would just sit up rocking back and forth, literally pulling my hair, like hitting myself in the head. Drink, don't drink, drink, don't drink. Just go to the gas station. Shut the fuck up. Just go to the gas station. Please be quiet. And my mom would walk in, see me. Honey, are you okay? Shut the fuck up, mom. Okay, honey. You know? I'm having a conversation. And that's what early sobriety was like for me. It was a 24/7 battle. Like, I could not get the voices in my head to stop telling me to go shoot dope, to go drink, to take a Xanax, to get some Suboxone, to smoke some weed, to do anything, right? And so I would get these phone lists, and I would start calling these women that you guys said to call, and no one would freaking answer, and then I'd get an instant resentment. I'd be like, I'm going to make these motherfuckers answer. I'm going to blow their phone up. Throwing my cell phone because no one will answer the phone. I'm not getting the results I want. But what that did, I realized it got me through that 10 minutes. It got me through that 20 minutes without picking up a drink or a drug. So how I came across my sponsor. So let me tell you guys this. I said earlier I have this need to be needed, so I would pick like really bad relationships. I would try to swoop in and be the hero. I would love you until you learn how to love yourself. You got an ex-husband and kids and baggage. I love you, girl. You know, like, I love you so much. And I would pick these relationships where I could fulfill a role. You know what I mean? Because I didn't know who I was. I had no sense of identity or purpose. But in a relationship like that, I did have a sense of identity and purpose. But when those relationships would fail, I would have a needle back in my arm again. And so the same kind of thing happens with sponsorship for me, right? Like, my picker's broken. I pick a sponsor. It's a man. We're not really supposed to have men sponsors, but I'm special because I'm gay. I pick a woman sponsor that I'm super attracted to, then I don't want to talk to her because I'm nervous. You know, so this time around, coming back into the rooms, these two women walk up to me at, like, my second meeting. and I'm shaking and I'm pissed off and I'm looking down at the ground and I hate my life. And this woman named Patrice, like, literally floats up to me, right? She doesn't walk, she floats. She's like an angel. And Julie, my sponsor, comes up to me and they're like, "I'm Patrice and I'm Julie and we're going to be your sponsors." I'm like, I'm so fucked up, I have to have two? Damn. All right. But I said, all right, that's cool. Y'all just tell me what to do. And so the difference this time around was God appointed me my sponsorship family. He was like, you suck at picking people. So I'm going to take your decision-making away. I'm going to take your choice away, and I'm just going to appoint these two women to you. And I'll tell you what, like, learning how to open up and be vulnerable without being naked with another woman was something that was very hard for me to do. I was still dope boy magic. I had my pants sagging down to here, my boxers showing, you know what I mean? I talked with this horrible slang. No one could understand what I was saying or texting. And I have this angel who's all about some Jesus. And then I have Julie, who's Miss Frickin' Jazzercise Aerobics Fitness Real Estate Soccer Mom. You know what I'm talking about? And I'm like, what am I supposed to talk to these women about? Like, what? You know, we come from two different worlds. But I was so desperate that I would pick up that phone and I'd be like, Julie, I don't know how to wake up without taking a few shots of liquor and then, like, throwing it back up and taking a few more shots of liquor. Like, how do I do this? My routine's all jacked up. And she's like, just get up, brush your teeth, use the bathroom, take a shower. I'm like, okay, and then what do I do? And she's like, then call me back. I was like, all right. So I would do that. Like, all right, I did that. What do I do now? Go make yourself some breakfast. Okay. And I'll call her back. Okay, what do I do now? And that's how early sobriety was for me. I was literally a baby, and I had to allow my sponsorship family to grow me up in this program. My routine was to wake up, take some shots of liquor, throw it up, take some more shots of liquor, brush my teeth, throw it up, take some more shots of liquor, brush my teeth again. And I didn't know how to do anything outside of that routine. And I remember calling her one day and just being like, Julie, I just, like, I'm so worthless. I have no self-esteem. I have no confidence. I don't know what I'm supposed to do in life. Like, I have nothing. I'm 24 years old. She'd say, honey, this saved my ass, you guys. She'd say, honey, if you don't do anything else other than get through the day without picking up a drink or a drug and putting the cap back on the toothpaste, just know you did enough that day and you are enough. And I was like, word. I can put the cap back on the toothpaste. And I was so proud. You know, so proud. I put the cap back on the toothpaste today, you know. But it gave me a job, right? It gave me something to focus on, something to do, something I accomplished for that day. And I remember, like, I have really bad time management. I still do. And I would be running late for something, and I'd be like, fuck, I didn't put the cap back on the toothpaste. And I'd run back in the house, and I'd be late because I'd put the cap back on the toothpaste. But as long as that was done, I was good. So that's still a part of my routine today, you guys. Swear to God, I'm going to make a t-shirt that says, just put the cap back on the toothpaste, because it saved my ass. And it's all these little things that I've picked up bits and pieces from the fellowship that have saved my ass and continue to this day. That's a part of my new routine now, you know, instead of throwing up shots of liquor. So the steps, I was so hungry for relief, right? I was so hungry for relief from my internal condition, which was fear and anxiety and self-loathing and anger. I said, when can I start my steps? When can I start my steps? When can I start my steps? You need to stabilize a little bit before we start doing your step work. I'm like, why? Why won't you let me do my steps? So I would, like, argue with my sponsorship family of why I couldn't start my steps. They just needed me to chill out for, like, 30 days, for, like, 60 days. And so when I started doing my steps, 1, 2, and 3 was like, bam, 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 yes, 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 done, done, done. Okay, how do I write my 4-step inventory? My head was so fried because, remember, I have drain damage. You know what I'm talking about? From overdosing. My head was so fried, I could not understand the stupid columns in the big book. I'm like, resentment's going this. What is my part? What do you mean my part? I don't have a part in this. Like, I just don't. Where do the columns go on the paper? Do I put the paper like this? Do I put the paper like hot dog? Like, how do I do the paper? Is there a form? What is this saying? But I was so frustrated with myself. I called my sponsor crying, and I was like, dude, I feel so stupid, but I don't understand it. And so my grand sponsor stepped in, and she's like, honey, just write out your life story on paper, and then we're going to read through it. I was like, okay, bet I can do that. So I'm working at this answering service, and we have little scrap pieces of paper, right, like this big. So I'm writing out my life story on these little scrap pieces of paper. And what I did was I realized, okay, I can't get stuck, right? I can't get stuck on these bad memories and go into the to this, like, pit of depression or, like, self-loathing. And so constantly taking calls, but when I'd get off a call, I'd write a little bit more, and then I'd get a call, and then I'd write a little bit more, and then I'd get a call, and I'd write a little bit more, and that's how I did my four-step. And I had, like, a stack of papers, like, this big because they were so small. And I remember, like, going to read my fifth step, doing my fifth step, with my sponsor and my grand sponsor. It was like double trouble. But as I went through this fifth step with them, all this stuff started to become clear to me. I've lived my life from a victim status, a victim mentality. The world has victimized me. God has victimized me. My family has victimized me because of my sexuality, because I'm an alcoholic, because I'm a junkie. I am a victim of circumstance, right? And I truly believe that. And so I held on to all these resentments and all this self-pity. But as I'm doing my fifth step, the veil of delusion that I have lived in my entire life was totally lifted. And I'm reading off these resentments about what she did to me and he did to me and that motherfucker over there. And I was like, oh, I did that to them. I did even worse to them. And I remember doing this, 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 and this to my family. Like, I'm not deserving of this victim status, right? Because I have actually victimized others. And I could start seeing my part in things, and I could no longer play the victim, and I could no longer sit in self-pity. So I was able to accept some responsibility. 7, 8, and 9 was like the experience that I had completely surrendering, giving myself over to God, being ready for him to remove all of my defects of character. That's one of the most, like, memorable moments for me personally in my step work process. Because that day that I hit my knees, I have this spot at the lake I like to go up to and talk to God. And I hit my knees at the lake, and I didn't give a shit who was looking at me and what they were thinking. And I just gave it all over, man. And I said this prayer, and it was the most powerful, intense prayer I've ever said. And I literally, I can't explain the feeling I got. I just can't explain it, but all this, I don't even know how to put words to it. I cried, I sobbed, I was grateful. Things just changed for me at that point when I just completely gave it up over to God, the good, the bad. And I said, God, please just make me your piece of clay and mold me into whatever you want me to be. And that's exactly what has happened. I took, you know, decision-making and life out of my hands, and I placed it over to the care of my higher power and this fellowship, you know, and making amends. I mean, it's a lifelong process for someone like me, but there's some huge moments in my life. My girlfriend I mentioned earlier that ended up taking her own life, it took me 2 years to be able to go out to her grave and read that amends letter to her, you know, 2 freaking years to do that shit. I was terrified to face it. And my sponsor just said, okay, honey, whenever you're ready. Okay, honey, whenever you're ready. She never pushed things with me. She was exactly what I needed. And so when I was able to go out there, at her grave, you know, the sun's setting, I'm reading this letter, I'm terrified, I'm shaking, I'm crying, I'm screaming, I'm snots going everywhere, you know, and then I'm face down across her grave, thanking God for where I'm at in my life today. And that's the kind of experiences that I've been so scared to walk through that God has taken full circle and made them some of the most powerful moments in my life for me. All because of these slogans, suit up and show up, right? Just put in the footwork and leave the results up to God. You know, fear, right? Fight everything and run. Fuck everything and run. Or face everything and rise. All these little slogans have actually gotten me through and gave me some of the most powerful experiences I've had. In 2014, my mom had this really rare form of cancer, and she had to have this pretty major surgery. And so this was a time for me to really step up and be there and be a member of my family. And so, you know, I'm working in treatment, and I'm working 3:30 to midnight. You know what I'm talking about. working 3:30 to midnight, and then I'm leaving work in North Georgia, and I'm driving to Marietta, and I'm staying up all night with my mom to make sure she's okay, you know, and then I'm going back into work, and we're doing this routine for like a month. She's in the hospital. She gets out of the hospital. She's got like a colostomy bag and all this shit, and I'm staying at her house with her, and I'm emptying her bag, and I'm bathing her, and I'm shaving her legs, and all the time, like, I'm doing this, I'm just grateful. I'm just so grateful that I'm able to show up, and I'm being mindful of the fact that, Aaron, you're making a living amends to your mother right now. You are showing up for her today. You are a living part of this family today. You are reliable. You are dependable. You are trustworthy. You're none of these things in active addiction, and I'm giving all the gratitude up to my higher power. Not long after that, I'm at work, okay? And I get this phone call, and it's like, you need to come home. You really need to come home. It's really bad. And they won't tell me what's going on. And I'm like, okay, it's my mom. My dad's killed himself because he struggles really bad with depression. So work lets me leave. I get home, and my sister and my mom are standing there, and they're like, it's your cousin. It's Taylor. He's gone. And this has been a life-changing moment for me. My cousin was a heroin addict just like I was. And no matter how hard we fought for him and tried to reach him in his addiction, he just didn't make it, and he overdosed and died. And my grandmother walked in and found him just like this, you know, dead. And she said, I think he was praying. And the knowledge I have, I'm like, no, he was, I didn't say this, but I'm like, no, he was getting high. You know, and so this is a moment where any other time in my life, I would have gone and gotten high, I would have gone and gotten drunk, I would have left, I would have ran away. And the promises came true for me in that moment. And it said, you will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. And I looked at my family after I broke down, and I said, I've got to go over there, I've got to clean out his room, because you guys don't deserve to go through that. So my brother took me over there, and I'm cleaning out his room, and I'm unfolding socks, and I'm finding dope baggies rolled up in socks and shit like that. And, you know, the impact his death had on me, when I finally went back to work, they gave me a couple weeks off. When I went back to work and we had to do room searches in the treatment center for clients, when I would walk in, I would see socks, I would freeze, and the memories of unrolling my cousin's socks that day would come back, and I would lose my shit, and I would start crying. And clients would come up to me and tell me all their stories and talk about how they wanted to leave treatment. And I would just think about my cousin, and I would start crying. And I was so blessed, you guys, because how I ended up working in treatment was just God putting me exactly where I needed to be. Not even because I have something to give to others, but because he knew I would need to be surrounded by recovery at certain points in my life. So at that point in my life, recovery, AA, had infiltrated every part of it. My family, my friends, the fellowship, my relationship, my job. I was surrounded 24/7 by sober members of, you know, of recovery doing the deal. And I allowed these people to handle me, to carry me through this, because I didn't know how to get through this alone. One thing my sponsor said to me was, on her worst days, when she feels like she can't go on, she lays down face down on the floor, spread eagle, and she prays to God like that. And that's what I did. Once again, like all these little things my sponsor told me, I start doing. And the day of his funeral came, and I was like, I don't know how I'm going to get through this. I laid face down on the floor, and I was like, God, I don't know what you want me to do with this, and I don't know how I'm supposed to face this day today. But I know you're not going to let me do it alone. You know, and the fellowship showed up for me. And so I'll tell you what, like, how I got working in treatment. I started telling my story at this treatment center. And then it was like, hey, you know, come apply for a job. I was like, okay, I guess this is God speaking to me. This is what he wants me to do, right? And I was scared. I didn't know how to dress for an interview. I had no self-confidence. I'd never worked in treatment before. And I went and I met this very intimidating redheaded man that's probably standing over there. And talking with him for 10 minutes, he looked at me and he said, I'm not going to give you a job. I'm going to give you a career. And I was like, what? Okay, You know, like, all right, I don't think he knows who he's talking to right now. Like, I'm a junkie. And that's exactly what this man did for me. And as that year, 2014, went on, three of my family members died. It was like my cousin, my grandfather, and my great aunt, three very important members of my family, very important people in my life. And every time I got that phone call, I was at work. And every time I went to Todd or I went to one of my coworkers and I just let them hold me and I just lost it and I cried in their arms. They showed up for me at the funeral. They allowed me time off. They would let me come and lose it in the office when I needed to, and they just helped me get through it. And you guys, that's what I want to express to y'all. If we will allow people in, right, the gifts we get, the blessings we get, that we can't even imagine them. Why I needed to be surrounded by recovery at these points in my life. I thought I was there because I was serving a purpose. No, God had me there because he knew I would need that kind of support to get through 2014. It was the worst year of my sobriety, right? After that, I had to go on medication. I had to start doing therapy. The grief was unreal. I couldn't function. I was losing time. I was losing my memory. I was not okay. You know, but the program and God and outside help, thank God for that, carried me through. You know, since that point in my life, there's a couple things I've learned from losing people, from this disease, from losing my cousin, is to really care about, treat the people that I have in my life, really truly care about them, be present with them each moment I have. No matter where they're at in their journey, whether they're sitting there high in front of me, love them anyway. My sister's a practicing addict and alcoholic, and I've really struggled with that throughout my recovery, of jealousy, of bitterness, of worry and fear, of wanting to fix her and help her and force her into treatment. And after my cousin died, I realized I just need to appreciate the time I have with her, with no matter where she's at in her journey. And today we have the best relationship we've ever had. I just moved her out of her, you know, abusive boyfriend's house, who's also an addict and an alcoholic, and we got her set up in her house, and we hang out like three times a week. And yeah, she's drunk, and yeah, she's popping pills, but none of that matters to me. What matters to me is continuing to show up in a loving and supportive manner in the relationships in my life. That's what losing people from this disease has taught me. It's made me a bigger person. It's made me a better person facing that loss. You know, every time one of us goes back out and relapses and we die of an overdose or we die of that lifestyle, I do feel a sense of responsibility. I feel a sense of responsibility to be of service to my fellow peers today, right? My fellow men and women. And when one of us dies, I ask myself, what could I have done better? How could I have been better in that person's life if it's someone close to me, right? Could we have gone out and looked for him when he was down there shooting dope? That just happened. Right? This guy leaves treatment, and we talk about going and looking for him, and for whatever reason, we decide not to, and he dies that night, and I carry that responsibility with me. If I am able to, I should absolutely do it. If I can make the time to reach out to somebody else, I should absolutely do it. It is my duty as a person in recovery, right, as a warrior that fights this shit on a daily basis for myself and for others, it is my duty to show up for my brothers and sisters today. And when I don't, I feel guilty, right? When I'm not being of maximum service to my fellow man, my gut lets me know, that God conscious lets me know, you're not doing enough. You are not fulfilling your sense of purpose. I've fought my entire life to find my sense of purpose, and this program in recovery has given that to me. So when I'm not owning that, I don't feel right within myself, and it's a good identifier that something needs to change. I need to get outside of myself, and I need to reach out to you guys. So my life today is amazing. It's wonderful. I have all the blessings any of us could ask for. I am going through a divorce, but I'm still grateful. I've recently changed jobs, and it's stressful, but I'm grateful. I'm a homeowner, like what, you know, someone let me like babysit their 4-year-old kid today. And I was looking in my back seat, like there's like a kid in my car with me. Who did that? All my friends were like, what were they thinking? But he's still alive. You know, like we got through the day and we had a really great day. And I have this fellowship. There's a lot of people sitting in this room right now. what makes my life so wonderful and gives me so much joy and fulfillment today are the relationships in my life. It's not the materialistic things. It's the people sitting in this room. It's the service work. It's the sponsorship. It's the friendships, the lifelong bonds that this program has given me. Because I got humble, I surrendered, I became willing, and I suit up and show up no matter what today. And I allow you guys and I allow God to help me, to work through me, to work through you, you know, to get me through life today. And it gives me a sense of fulfillment. That's nothing I've ever had before. My heart's full. I have a sense of peace on a daily basis. I have a feeling of connection on a daily basis. I don't feel alone anymore in a crowded room or even sitting by myself. I can sit with myself today, going through a divorce, having life stressors, financial stressors, job stressors. I can be alone at night in my own bed, and I feel good about who I am today. And that's something I never had before. I hope you guys got something out of this tonight, and I really appreciate your patience and just listening. So thank you.
Yeah, see? You're supposed to. So I pressed it, right?